Yeah, he's like, wait a second, maybe that was Webpack just half a shed, but I need to look at the freaking code because I need to have my proxy open. Valentino. So when you're running an enterprise security program, there are quite a few things you need to nail before you even consider doing something like running a bug bounty program, right? These are kind of like the ABCs of enterprise security. Obviously, you need some sort of phishing prevention system. You need an EDR. You need some introspection into your environment with logging. And of course, you need some sort of patch management system to make sure that your software is constantly up to date. And not gonna lie, guys, that last one is a little bit of a pain in the butt, right? I know you guys know what I'm talking about with that. It's a lot. And whenever there is something that's a pain in the butt in security, what happens? Well, ThreatLocker always comes up with an innovative solution. And that's exactly what they've done with ThreatLocker Patch Management. Their team is working constantly to ensure the software updates for software in your ecosystem are audited, categorized. So if there's like a super severe 0 day, you'll definitely know about it. And then check for conflicts with other software on your system before enabling the enterprise admin to automatically update or schedule an update in the future. And I'll just read this little snippet from their website really quick, which I loved. It says, "We'll even dare to say, install ThreatLocker Patch Management and forget about patch management. We've got it covered." That is what you love to hear. That is what you love to hear, right? Okay. So definitely check it out, guys. ThreatLocker.com/platform/patch-management, or just go to ThreatLocker.com. And look for the patch management software. All right, that's a wrap. Let's go back to the show. All right, we're rolling. Valentino, my man, we've been wanting to do this episode ever since the live hacking event in Google. Thanks so much for coming on the pod today.
Yeah, I am grateful to be here. So,
Yeah, dude, I'm looking at this doc with the prep that you've done for this episode, and it is one of my favorite types of docs that I like to see, which is just absolutely stacked with hacking stories, you know, I often really like to see, you know, people bringing on new research, and I really like to see people bringing on fun bug stories. Those two are the ones that I get really, really hyped. So we've got tons of really good bug stories in here. So let's kick it off. Well, okay. Typically, I kick it off with a little bit of a bug story. So let's see what we've got here. We've got four different options. Take your pick, man. Which one do you want to talk about?
There are so many stories, but I think I will start with the first. So it is pretty simple. I had a Tomcat instance. So with Tomcat, sometimes a system administrator use a reverse proxy to expose it. So basically, It was exposed with a reverse proxy, but it had the default credentials. So basically, using the research published by Orange DCA, which is called path normalization issues or something like that, you can basically use ... semicolon and bypass use a path traversal to access the manager behind the reverse proxy.
So what was happening here? So that's that ... semicolon payload, right? Yeah. Is that the right one? Yeah. So that's like, I freaking love that research by Orin Tsai. What a brilliant way to do it. So I guess what was happening there was, you know, you had a specific path that was allowed by the reverse proxy. And then you know, the reverse proxy wasn't seeing ... semicolon as a path traversal.
Yes.
And then, you know, the backend server was, and that's what allowed you to get access to that Tomcat
instance. Exactly. Just that. And
I love it, man.
There was another step, which when you access with admin the Tomcat manager, you basically weren't allowed to upload files. It was restricted to localhost. That's where I found the JMXX proxy. Sorry for my pronunciation.
No, you're good. You're good. JMX proxy. Okay.
So if you can't upload a file being logged in Tomcat because it was restricted to localhost, you can basically use that proxy to JMX to exploit that and get RC, basically.
Oh, dude, this is just, check this out. This is just straight up like RC as a service here, JMX, this JMX proxy thing. Wow, solid. Okay, so if we ever run into those scenarios where you can't hit, you know, the traditional Tomcat manager instance like you would and be able to upload a shell because of the restrictions to localhost, then, you know, we go instead and hit this /manager/JMX proxy. And then that one will allow us to execute code either way.
Yeah, the only problem is that you need to have the role called to call that endpoint. But sometimes it is misconfigured, so you can just call it.
You need to have the role, is that what you said?
Yes, sometimes people just keep all the roles without thinking, and yeah, you can basically exploit this.
Classic. I love it, man. That's a good takeaway, because I think I see these often, man. I was very surprised. I can't say the name of the target, but there was a target I was hacking on once that is literally like a household name. Like, I used this thing as a kid often. Like, and on www.thatsite.com, there was a path traversal just like this, just ..:/, and then it was dropping you right into some place where you could execute code. So I think these reverse proxy setups that a lot of people like to use, if you can detect them, I think that there's a large attack surface there for some sort of scanner that we haven't really seen hit the scene, you know, just yet, of like, okay, here are the application segments. You know, at /assets, now we're looking at an S3 bucket. You know, at /app, we're looking at this, you know, .NET backend. You know, at whatever, we're looking at some static Nginx assets or whatever, right? If we can identify these application segments on a target, then oftentimes there's a lot of weird vulnerabilities we can do with path normalization.
Yeah, it is crazy. Orange does all that stuff, and it is crazy. You can get so many things. Yeah.
What is this other write-up you linked here that was on Wayback URLs that isn't up anymore? Some Chinese write-up or something like this?
I was stuck in this issue, in that part that I told you I couldn't upload files. And I found this Chinese blog, and I found that you could exploit that proxy. That was the key to...
That's where the JMX manager thing came from.
Yeah.
Nice, man. Yeah. Nice. We'll link that down in the description. That's hilarious, though. Oh, yeah. And they even list an exploit. Tomcat JMX RCE exploit. Very cool.
Yeah. Okay. It basically is log poisoning, basically.
Oh, really? Okay. Nice. Log poisoning, dude. I think log poisoning is on everybody's radar now, ever since the log4j thing, where it's like, oh my gosh, this has got to be all over the place.
Yes.
That's pretty sick. Yeah, I definitely, recently I've been on something I've been working on. I've been off of hacking almost since the Google Live hacking event. I've just had a bunch of stuff come up. I've been working with a couple companies. And just this past couple weeks, I've been back hacking on bug bounty programs again. And like blind XSS in logs, or like you're talking right here, log poisoning with some server-side logic. Such a fun type of vulnerability. It feels a little wishy-washy to me, though, sometimes, because I'm like, you know, I'm trying all these random things. I'm trying to guess what's happening on the back end. And I just hope something calls back, you know?
Yes, I love to black box the hugging.
It's a totally different skill, right? I mean, than white box testing. You know, there are a lot of really talented white box testers that I know, but when you see a really talented black box tester, it's like they've got some like sixth sense of what's happening with the application. And I think all of us have that to some degree, right? That have been successful in the industry. But there are some people that are just like, yeah, that is definitely how they coded it. Let me just say, I'm like, what the heck?
Yeah. In the Google event, it seemed like that. Like,
yeah.
I was just, oh, yeah, this might work. And it worked, but it didn't make sense. Then it took like an entire week to find the cause. It's like,
yeah, absolutely, man. All right, well, you presented your bug, you proved your hackerhood to the listeners. I'll give you a quick intro, and then we'll hit some of these other bugs real quick. So as I mentioned, guys, this is Valentino. I met Valentino at the Google Live Hacking event in Tokyo, or maybe it was the one before that.
Vegas. I think yes, Vegas.
Yeah, in Vegas. That's right. It was in Vegas that we met the first time. But then in Tokyo, we were kind of neck and neck for the MVH there. And sitting next to Valentino at dinner, you know, we talked about a lot of bugs, and I was really impressed with his methodology. So I wanted to get him on the live talk at the Google event, but we didn't get to do it because of timelines being constricted. But we do have the opportunity to do that now, so I'm very excited. Let's go ahead and jump through the rest of these, Valentino, and talk through some of these. Well, no. All right, let me back out. You've already proved your worth. Now let's go into a little bit of history. How did you get into InfoSec and hacking, and then we'll get into the rest of the bugs that you've popped.
Okay, so I got into InfoSec when I was around 12 years old. I didn't even know what I was doing. Today, I kind of know a bit. So in that time, I was playing a lot of Minecraft, like 12 hours a day. My parents were telling me, please, you need to study, stop playing that game. So one day I got bored of the game and I started to learn how to make servers. So by building servers, I noticed that, let's say, the servers are basically networks. You have multiple mini games and you have like an authentication server where you log in, then a lobby, and then you can access whatever mini game you want. So I noticed that the mapping proxy was just specifying each mini game as a port. So I thought, what if I just access the mini game directly? It's like a no brainer. So I did, and it worked. And it was my first issue.
Dude, what? How hype must have you been at like 12 or 13, dude? But like, yes, it worked, you know? Like,
I was scanning entire BPS providers, like the entire blocks, all night.
Oh, the ASN ranges, yeah.
My parents told me, what is this charge about the BPS? And I told them, no worries, I am learning server administration.
There you go. Nice, man. I also started hacking when I was like 12, and the sketchy stuff that we do at that age to learn how to hack stuff, man. It's great, but it was such an exciting time too, you know? Like when you first pop something and something actually worked, some exploit actually worked, it's like, that's the best feeling.
Yeah.
I think Minecraft as well, dude. I think Minecraft has been a piece of software that just pushes people towards highly technical roles, right?
Yeah.
Like not only does the game, you know, have a lot of programming like components with all the stuff you can do with like the buttons and automation and stuff like that, but also, you know, this whole concept of hosting servers and, you know, running that business or running that from a hacking perspective has just brought so many people into the technical realm.
Yeah, it is crazy. I know many people that are gamers, that were gamers, and then hackers. It's like really common. Yeah.
Yeah. Very common flow. Very nice, man. So you got into it a little bit at 12. Where does the story pick up after that?
After that, there were some protections that were implemented, and I liked the idea of bypassing those protections. So there was a protection that basically checked that the origin IP was localhost, and well, it was bypassable.
Oh my gosh.
You can just spoof the IP and that's it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, dude. And then that's another set of vulnerabilities on all of these Minecraft targets. Wow.
It is similar to cores, I think. The origin thing, and it is. I learned so many things in Minecraft that I applied in web hacking. It's like so nice.
Yeah, dude, absolutely. So how did you make the jump from hacking Minecraft stuff over to being a pen tester or a bug bounty hunter?
So at that time, my parents basically restricted my access to the computer.
Yeah,
so
classic.
I had to study in school for 2 years. And then when I was 16, when I got better at the school, I returned to hacking, but knowing the stuff behind, like I started learning programming, and then I learned Java, the basics of security, and then I started with Hack the Bots. It is a lab for CTF, and yeah, that's the point where I learn a lot of stuff, and I started hacking with labs, not with real world targets. Like,
yeah, I think you know, likewise, when I was 12, 13, 14, 15, a lot of the stuff I was hacking on was, you know, illegal hacking stuff, you know, things that I didn't have authorization to hack on. Because I think at the time there wasn't labs as easily accessible as well, or at least I didn't know about them, right? And so then, you know, once we get access to, I also remember when I went to college, you know, when I was 18 or so, I like figured out, oh, there's this thing called Metasploitable or whatever, right? Where you can, or Damn Vulnerable Web Application, where you can set that stuff up and then you can start like honing your skills, and it's based off of real vulnerabilities, and you can do it in a lot more ethical way. But I'm sure that there are a lot of kids out there even today that are just like, yeah, I hadn't really put the thought into, oh, maybe there's a lab out there where I can practice this rather than just popping shells on people's web servers randomly.
Yeah, that's bad. Yeah, the problem is that kids might think it is fun, but it is fun, but it is illegal. So don't do it.
Exactly, right? Exactly. I'm looking at the rest of the notes here, man, and it looks like you did the OSCP, and then, quote, after getting that certification, I received some job offers, and the day after my 18th birthday, I started my first pen testing job. Dude, that is a pretty sick record, man. Like starting your first pen testing job the day after you turned 18. So you were getting the OSCP before you were 18 even?
I started the OSCP when I was 17, because I had to do the final year in my school, but I chose to not do it. I choose to do it at from home, homeschooling.
Homeschooling, yeah.
I just spent like 2 days a week for school and the entire week for hacking. So,
dude, okay, my man, you were also homeschooled. I was homeschooled all of my childhood, like, and it was great because whenever I was hacking something, right, or doing some programming job like I was when I was younger, I would often go up to my mom and be like, "Hey, mom. So I got this like programming job. I'm gonna do this for the next couple of days, and then I'll catch up on math or English, right, or whatever, right?" And she was like, "All right, just don't, you know, way to go, honey. Like, I'm glad you're making money. Just make sure you don't get behind on school. And then as long as I got my school caught back up, then we were good to go." And I credit that with so much of my success, you know, as a hacker and as a programmer. Just being able to have that flexibility and entrepreneurial spirit at a young age, and then being able to implement it without, you know, having to be locked up at school all day.
Yeah, in those times, you have so much free time that you can just be quick with the school and hack.
Exactly, man. Exactly. Yeah. I love that. That's amazing. You're one of the only other people I've ever met that, you know, was homeschooled as well and used that time to go hack stuff. Yeah. That's clutch, man. Is that common at all in Argentina, or is that
No, it is not common. But there are some people that can do it. I just did the last year, but because I was tired of school, it's like 5 hours a day, 5 days a week. It was a lot, like.
It is a lot, yeah. And shout out to your parents for allowing you to do that. I mean, I think that's pretty cool that they were open to that sort of thing. I know here in the US, homeschooling is like skyrocketing. Like the amount, I think it's grown 50% year over year for the past like 5 years. Like, it's just getting massive.
Yeah.
And so I was really glad to see that. And sometimes it can be done really, really poorly, and the people are not learning their stuff and they're getting socially isolated. But for me, you know, with parents that were actively involved, and I still got to play my sports and, you know, had a community outside, as well as a you know, very intentional education at home, it worked super well.
Yeah, it depends on the parents. And yeah, it can be very well. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So we're 18 years old. We have a pen testing job. We're 18 years old in one day, and we're starting a pen testing job. How do you get into Bug Bounty, and how did you get invited to the Bug Squad event for Google?
It was really random. Like, I think most things that happened with Google were random for me, at least. I was thinking, okay, I saw a tweet that asked, do you want to hack AI in a private event? And I said, okay. I sent the form, and I thought, yeah, they are not going to call me. There are more qualified people than me. So yeah, I waited. And I got the email, and I said, what? So I started learning how to hack AI. Mm. And in the first event, it was really hard. And another thing is that they just told me, do you want to go to Vegas? And I said, I can't go to Vegas because I can't pay for the flight and the hotel. It is expensive.
Yeah.
So yeah, they told me, what if we pay for it? And I said, definitely, yes, of course. Yeah. And I went.
Dude, that's crazy, man. Like, so at that point, had you submitted a lot of bugs to Google, or?
I think I sent like 2 bugs that weren't that great. I registered to the Google account in the same month I did the hacking event, and but I didn't particularly send high impact bugs, and I got the invitation. In that moment, I thought, why I got the invitation, but. Yeah, I knew I had to put my efforts.
Yeah, yeah. This is what I'm saying, man. Everybody's still early on Google, right? Like this. When was this, Valentino? This was Las Vegas, right? This is Vegas 2024.
This was in 2023.
Okay, gotcha. 2023 Vegas was when you first went with the Google program.
Yes.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. So guys, it's still early with Google, man. I mean, just a couple of years ago, not even 2 years ago, 1 year ago and some change, Valentino is like submitting 2, you know, crappy bugs and then getting an invite to Vegas. So it's an amazing opportunity. Definitely spend some time on Google. But Valentino, man, it is kind of scary, right? I mean, hacking on Google, they have a lot of obfuscation. There's a lot of proto-JSON, right? There's a lot of, you know, very minified products, and so what are your tips and tricks on hacking on Google for the listener that wants to take up that opportunity?
For me, it is getting really used with one product. If you can talk with the security team, because they know a lot of stuff, and basically, the thing that worked for me is. Stop looking at the code. Stop looking at the requests. Close the proxy. Like.
Valentino, my guy, this is crazy advice, but it worked for you, right? I've seen it work for you.
Because there are so many things that happen in this application that you need some time to think what is happening in the backend. What is the application loading? You need to think like the developer. It's like poker, I think. You need to get in the head of the people that made the application. And then you need to look, I look for patterns. I try things that are weird and break stuff. And then I see what happened and how it happened. All the bugs I found during the event, I didn't use a prot.
Dude, that is just absolutely nuts. And it's crazy to me because, you know, when we were sitting at that dinner, right? That awesome dinner in Tokyo, and we were chatting about the bugs that you found. I was listening to this and I was like, ah, yeah, duh. Why didn't I, like, all of the attack vectors that you came up were so like simple, but creative,
yeah,
and like showed a depthful understanding of the product, right? And where the security boundaries are. And I'm really like, I'm glad to have you on the pod, dude, because I think there are a lot of different types of hackers out there, right? There are people that are just obscenely technical and will just like, you know, and looking at some of the stuff in here, you got a little bit of both for sure, right? But you know, there are some people that are just, all they do is focus on like the white box parts, the code where they can, the part where they can get their hands on the code. They read it, they fully understand it, they bend it, right? And then there's people that are just unbelievably creative with their attack vectors, right? And there's such a beauty to that latter piece, right? And the first is, I think, more of a science. The latter is more of an art, right? Where it's like,
yeah,
you know, crafting these really creative attack scenarios. And to be honest, for the listener, I think you should be encouraged, because for the creative piece, there are a couple hackers that I know that are not very, very technical. I'm thinking of one friend that I have that has earned, you know, multiple five-figure bounties just from being a insanely creative hacker and just using the UI, right? No proxy, no dev tools, no nothing, just clickety, 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 click. So it definitely is possible, right?
Yeah, and it is crazy. I couldn't find issues using the proxy and all the things. And then I closed the proxy and I started finding a lot of bugs that were crazy. Yeah. I started thinking, I think it is a critical thing.
But there you go.
I will add another thing, which is abstract thinking is really important.
Mm.
The problem is there are hackers that, it is not a problem, it is something, but the thing is that there are hackers that need to know all the details, like the code, everything. But sometimes you need to really understand that you will lack information, and you need to be comfortable with lacking information and guessing a bit.
Dang, dude. That's deep. That hits me right in the heart, man. I'm one of those guys that needs to see all of the pieces, right? I'm not very good at not having, you know, some of those pieces. And for me, you know, when I'm hacking on stuff, I do try to line all those pieces up in my brain. I'll write it down, I'll map it out, I'll draw it. I've got these big yellow notepads that I have around that I just sketch and like draw and try to get it, you know, all in one piece. But I need to be more comfortable with the abstract, right? With the uncertain pieces, and just kind of take guesses at what's happening or educated, you know, guesses at what could be happening. That's pretty rad.
It is hard. It is hard. For me, it is hard to do the thing you do. Like knowing the entire application deeply, it is hard for me because I get distracted a lot. Mm. But I kind of feel it is easier to just have some information and just make an inference, like inference with abstract thinking, and it sometimes works.
Yeah, absolutely, man. All right, let's take a look at a couple examples of that. You know, one of the ones that was interesting that highlights, I think, that abstract thinking was your vulnerability that was disclosed at Mercado Libre. With the HTML sanitizer. Can you talk a little bit about that? But that's a disclosed report, so we'll put it in the description for anybody who wants to follow along. But can you talk a little bit about what you found there?
Yeah, that was my first crazy bug. Like, it was the first time I thought in abstract terms. Mm. I basically saw a request that is basically in Mercolibre you can sell and buy products. So I tried making a buying a product and then making a claim. And then I saw the request with a claim and HTML code. And I said, what is happening here? It's like, why it is sending HTML code? So
this, when you say a claim, is this like when you've bought something and you need to like get some support or something like that from the seller or?
Yes, exactly. You're trying to make a claim to return the product or to say something is wrong, basically.
Okay. So you've got a support complaint and you're trying to get support for the product, maybe even return it.
Yes.
And when you do that, the message that you send contains HTML in it.
Exactly. Yes.
Dude, don't you love to see that though? My heart like skips a little beat like whenever I see those, you know, encoded HTML tags inside of my request. I'm like, yes, I know that there's going to be something interesting here.
Yeah, it is like awesome, but there was a sanitizer. sanitizer was a custom, I think. So I was able to make some guesses and bypass it. And that bypass was crazy because it had like a low list of tags, and when I sent multiple bit tags, it's hard to see like the picture, but there were many open tags that you can, if you send multiple open tags and then a malicious payload, it basically bypasses the filter for some reason.
Dude, it's crazy, man. It's crazy how some of this stuff happens, right? Like, so you just have open ptab, open ptab, open ptag, open ptag, open ptag, and then like your XSS payload, and the thing just starts reading the ptags. It's like, all right, yep, it's another pizza. All right, whatever, it's fine. You know, just let it through, and then it just opens up. That's nuts, man. Nesting stuff is really important when attacking a sanitizer.
Yeah, it is. I saw it is really important with the blogs made by Miso.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. There have been so many DOM purify bypasses because of the depth restraints and essentially having namespace confusions because of the sort of stack reaching maximum depth and then tags being normalized to the same, you know, spot within the nesting. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is like the most crazy thing is that in that time I didn't even look at the code. So I don't know the root cause. I don't know.
Valentino, that would drive me crazy. That would drive me, like, I cannot believe that you didn't go back and read the freaking sanitizer code afterwards, man. Like, I mean, unless it's happening on the server side and you can't, but you're just like, ptag, 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 ptag. Oh, it worked. Let's go submit the report. I'm like, dude.
It was crazy. And then they put DOM purify. So it is safer, okay. I think.
Bummer, man. Bummer. Well, I see you've got a section of this doc where you say that there are, you know, some patterns that are kind of sort of follow this structure in other pieces of hacking. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, sure. There were. Do you mean the part the patterns and the reflection?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So in this vulnerability, I reflected on it, and I think there are some things that we can take. There was an allow list, so you could basically wrap a malicious object inside a load object, and that bypasses the mitigations. It is really interesting because it is similar to insecure deserializations, where you have a low list, and then you can just wrap a evil object inside, and it works.
Yeah. I think it's really important that we reflect upon those sort of principles within hacking. That makes us much better hackers, is when we see this higher level pattern, right? And what you're pointing out here is that sometimes there are allow lists, right? And inside of those allow lists, you know, there can be sub objects, right? That should not be allowed. The thing that's assessing it may only go, you know, one layer deep, right? So there's this nesting part, there's this allow list part. We see this in SAML bypasses. We see this in, deserialization. We see this in sanitizing bugs, right? HTML sanitizing bugs. Definitely a common pattern that hackers need to be familiar with and apply to different areas of hacking.
Yeah, it is really cool how you can apply one technique from blockchain or like crypto hacking and apply it somewhere else. One day I did an experiment. I read a blog talking about a crypto bug. I didn't understand almost anything, but I read cash many times, and I thought this issue is universal. Like race conditions, sample escapes. It's like injection bugs. They are like patterns in software, like
all over the place, man. Yeah, especially crypto, because it's such a unique area, you know, with reentrancy attacks and stuff like that, you know, trying to take those principles and apply them to other areas and to take, you know, the areas of traditional web security and apply them to other things, right? We see this stuff happening with AI related vulnerabilities and every new area that pops up, there's the same old problems that we have from before, just taking a different form. All right, man. Now we've kind of gone through a couple of these. Let's hit the onslaught of really crazy bugs that you have in here and hear a bunch of stories. So I'm looking right now at the command injection in Vertex AI, one of the Google products. And this one, I read your little write-up on here beforehand. So cool, dude. So tell the listeners about that. I think they're really going to enjoy it. And can I share this doc, this related draft document, or?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I'll share it, and maybe it'll help the users visualize a little bit.
The command injection in Vertex AI, it was another crazy bug. I found without looking at the code.
Valentino, stop, man. What are you doing? Please don't do this to me. Oh my gosh. Okay. Tell me about it.
It is really fun because it was basically in Vertex AI, you have like a feature where you can text prompts with different models. So I noticed you can embed content, and then you can use a feature called get code, which generates code to call the APIs with your test prompt. So I thought, what if I just can use a quote and escape the and perform command injection? It didn't work. But then I thought, well, images are interesting, have been interesting with Google, so I just put an image and escape in a image URL, and then I got the command injection there.
Okay. Whoa, Valentino, hold up. You can't just say, and then I got the command injection. So what's going on here is this file that's being uploaded, if I'm understanding this write-up correctly.
Yes.
This file that's being uploaded is a JSON file, right? That represents what? A prompt?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Yes, I skipped that part.
No, you're good. Tell me about it.
So basically, the problem is that The command injection needed the user to copy and paste the content in the chat. So it was too much interaction. So I decided to find an indirect way of introducing that malicious content. So I found another feature called prompt management. That's where you can import a prompt with a JSON file, with some variables and data. And yeah, the attack is basically the user downloads a prompt file, imports it, and then after using the getcode, it injects the command escaping the URL which is inserted in that code.
Okay. Hold up a second. So, so you're taking a JSON attacker prepares a prompt template or whatever JSON file, and then they upload that to Vertex AI, right?
Yes.
And now the prompt that you've prepared is in their Vertex AI, and then you said they hit the get code button. What does the get code button do?
The get code basically generates a code to call the Google AI APIs to test the prompt.
Okay. So then this gives you some way to use this specific prompt that you've prepared via the Google APIs.
Yes.
Okay. And then when you do that, it generates some code, either some. Is it Bash, Python? What did you say it was in this scenario?
You have many options like Cool, Bash. Bash is Cool. Python and Node.js, etc. So,
wow. and so what was happening there was, you know, it would generate it, and it would somehow pass in this prompt, you know, to the I guess curl, let's just say curl in this scenario, in this curl request, right? So maybe it's using like, you know, binary data or just like dash D or whatever in curl, right?
Yes.
And then inside of that JSON, you were able to provide something that would break out of the JSON object within the so it's like a command line argument injection.
It was just command injection without anything tricks, like just the end of line.
Okay.
And you need to close the multi-line thing, and then you can just insert it. It wasn't complicated at all.
Nice. So I've seen this kind of bug several times, and it was really cool because the first time I saw it, it was done by Inti. I don't know if you know the hacker Inti. He's kind of OG in the bug bounty space. He did the ticket trick. Research back in the day, and we were at a live hacking event, and he got show and tell. He was like one of the best bugs of the event because he said RCE via content injection, and because he was able to generate like you did here, you know, inject into a code block that was supposed to be copied and pasted into, you know, somebody's code, you know, into their .php file at the time, right? And he was able to just specify arbitrary PHP within that, and then it would run on the victim server. And I think that this is a pretty niche bug, right? It's something that you see pretty often, but not a lot of people try as content injection inside of these very multi-contextual environments, right? Where there's lots of context. There's the curl context. There's the JSON context. There's the HTTP context. It's very, very cool attack vector.
Yeah, basically, because I mean, it requires some injection, but still, the origin is trusted, so you need to be careful.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's see. All right, Vertex AI, that one was pretty cool. Google gave you a good bounty for that. Let's come back to some of these other stories that you have up at the top. You mentioned deserialization earlier. It looks like you've done some work with .NET and Java deserialization. Do you want to talk about one of those too?
I won't say I know much about deserializations because I found the bug and I read the entire paper. Mm-hmm. And that was it. Like I did some research, like 2 weeks just to exploit the bug, and then I forgot about it. Like,
yeah. What paper were you reading at the time for deserialization that you used to exploit this?
I read many papers written by Alvaro Munoz, which are so great to start with deserialization. And then I read this massive paper by Piotr Basilo, which is awesome. Like, I feared deserializations way back, but that paper made me realize it is very fun and interesting to play.
Yeah, dude, this guy Piotr, oh my gosh, this is Chuddy PD.
Yeah,
dude, he's unbelievable, man. I've read some. We've covered some of his stuff on the pod before. I'd love to have him on the pod. The stuff that he comes out with, specifically surrounding the pwn-to-own research that he does, is like unbelievable. Very crazy stuff. All right. What's this? All right, jumping down the list. What is this argument injection to LFR in parsing component?
Oh, there was a time I had this was a white walls kind of hacking. So when I looked at the code, it seemed safe, but I found a way to shed an argument, and then it called a specific parsing tool. So I needed to basically read the manual and see which arguments I can use to get some impact. So I reverse engineered the binary a bit, and then I found a way to trigger a server side request forgery with a local file read and leak files.
Oh my gosh! So it was a argument injection. This was in a web app, I presume?
Yes.
Okay, so it's an argument injection from a web app. Web app is calling some sort of command line utility. That command line utility, you go in reverse, find, you know, you've got an argument injection in there. So you add an argument that takes a file from the user's local machine and somehow yeets it out to some, you know, throws it to some attacker-controlled server. Is that right?
Yeah, like to be more specific, basically, it prepares a request, and it reads a file that is supposed to be a header with some credentials or some data. So it sends that header in the request that is supposed to go to a server, legitimate server. But you can just put the etc password in the header value, and it works.
Yeah, you check your server's logs, and it's like, you know, authorization bearer. Root, you know, it just jumps the whole Etsy password file.
Yeah.
Dude, I love that, man. Hacky stuff like that, where it's like you get these malformed HTTP requests and somehow your server catches it. It's like, oh my gosh, I love this.
It is.
That's beautiful, man. That's really beautiful. All right, dude. I'm going down here. I'm looking at some of the other stuff you've got. I really liked this this thing that you called free after use, right? Not use after free, but free after use. I thought that was really funny. Can you tell us about that specific vulnerability, what happened there, and how the listeners can look for a similar vulnerability?
Yeah, basically there, I was looking for authorization issues like IDOR and all that, but it was tricky to find IDORs because they are so common that are fits very quickly. So I thought, what if I just access, basically the concept free after use is looking for moments where the application does some weird stuff when a specific user accesses a specific resource. In this case, an owner of a resource accessed his metrics, for instance, and then I could basically when the owner accesses the metrics, everyone can access the metrics. It's like when they nice. that's why I called it a what is called a free after use. The user,
use after free.
The owner uses the component and it is free. Like
then it becomes free for everyone. That's hilarious, man. So I think this is a pretty niche scenario. I have seen it before for sure, where you know some routes will just be for some reason like presented like that. It's an authorization issue. But one of the other places where you often see this is caching related vulnerabilities, right? Like if there is a server at some point somewhere that is caching whatever resource and then serving it, you know, and another person hits that resource once it's already in the cache, then it's not hitting any of the backend logic. It's just presenting that same data again to the other user. So very similar to web cache deception in that way.
Yeah, it is really similar to that. Yeah, and I know that I think it. Yeah.
Yeah, he's like, wait a second, maybe that was web cache deception, but I need to look at the freaking code because I need to have my proxy open. Valentino, oh my god, dude. Yeah. That's definitely a good one.
Yeah, for instance, relating to the sanitizer bypass earlier, when I read the don't verify misconfigurations and bypasses blog by Misu, I thought, oh, this is pretty similar to what I did. This is the bug.
So I'm wondering, Valentino, I know, you know, how old are you right now? Do you mind sharing on the pod or no?
What thing? Sorry,
How old are you?
Oh, now 21.
21. Okay, so you're a younger guy, right? You're a younger guy in this scene. You've been doing this for 3 years. I think you've had a lot of success here, clearly, finding a lot of vulnerabilities. Do you think that your evolution, you know, your growth as a hacker will come with understanding some of these things at a more technically depthful level? Or are you going to try to spend time trying to foster and grow in yourself that creative and abstract thinking? Which way do you see yourself going as a hacker? And maybe it's both, but I'm just curious.
I think there is a limit to creativity.
Mm.
So I think there is lack in that creativity. So I think I'm going to go to the more technical route to really understand the deeper parts. So I think that's a good idea.
I think that's a good progression. And I think you're right that there is luck and there is limits to creativity. Kind of crazy, though, that you play second at the Google Live hacking event off of that. So I think maybe you're like your creativity levels are like super high from a, you know, from a baseline perspective. And let me ask you this, you know, you sort of mentioned several times throughout this pod that you think that a lot of this has to do with spending a lot of time on an application, right? On the pod, we call it getting intimate with the application. You know everything about this application. You can, you know, hold it in your hands. You're like, I know exactly what you are. I think, you know, that do you find that creativity gets spurred more after you feel like you've understood all the parts of the application? Or do you think it's more as a part of that process of understanding everything about the application?
I think basically playing around with an application for a lot of time, like I have been sending bugs like to a single application for at least 2 years. Or it's like...
All right, guys, listen to what Valentino says here. Say it again for the people in the back, Valentino. Say it again.
I have been finding bugs in a single application for 2 years, but...
2 years. 2 years, guys. Listen to what Valentino is saying. So many people, Valentino, will say to me, I've been hacking on this app for so long. I can't figure it out. Can't get any bugs. I'm like, how long have you been hacking? They're like, 2 days. And I'm like, dude, like you haven't spent any time on this. I'm still reading the docs 2 days in, you know, sometimes. So I think it's really key what you mentioned here.
And sometimes you need to spend like 8 hours a day in a single application every day. Like in the first year, I spent like, I just look at the application like 4 hours, then the next month, 12 hours, and like keep revisiting the application, keep going back and check new things, new thoughts. I found in those 2 years, I found most of the bugs in 3 months. Like I started popping the bugs when I really understood the application, like a user, like someone that just tries the application, like uses the application.
Yeah, absolutely, man. That is super pivotal. And I wonder, Valentino, do you, you know, you mentioned, you said earlier that sometimes you get bored quickly. But you're spending a lot of time on these applications. Do you think that do you have to force yourself to refocus on some of these apps? Do you get bored with them but force yourself to come back to them?
Sometimes I get extremely interested in an application that I sometimes I have a different problem, which is I want to focus on Google Cloud and I can't because I keep going back to the same application. It's like a fixation. There are more bugs, but sometimes I, for instance, with Google Cloud, which is a target I am really starting to like, I really want to hack there, but I get like distracted all the time. Like it's like,
do you get distracted by new applications or by older applications or by both?
I get distracted by everything. Like I start reading the docs of Vertex AI and I start thinking what are the differences between, you know, that there are different servers in different regions and what are the differences between the languages or the encodings in different servers. And I think like crazy things that probably won't work. Like, do you know the Orange DCI, for instance, published a blog where he talked.
The what?
Orange DCI.
I don't think I know it.
No, he published a blog about encodings with SQL.
Is this the DEF CON talk on like injecting at the binary protocol for SQL?
Oh no. It was a CTF challenge.
I don't think I've seen it.
Like I decided to read all the CTF challenges made by Orange because he's a really cool researcher. And one write-up was that an A with a specific encoding is converted to an ASCII A, and you can basically bypass the admin check or things like that. And I thought that might work in Google Cloud. But if I start thinking about many things and I can't focus on a single thing right now, it's like, that's a problem.
Yeah, that is one of the problems with some of these big targets, right? Like Google Cloud or AWS and stuff. There's so many ideas kind of bouncing around and sometimes they're a little technically difficult to implement. And so I find myself sitting and scheming and writing down and stuff like that. And then I realize, but the only way I'm actually going to find vulnerabilities is if I try stuff, if I actually like go and technically implement it, right?
Yeah.
So I got to pause for a second and then make sure I'm keeping my throughput of like things that I've tried. I got to keep that high so that I can keep my vuln output high.
And Google is so massive and so like at first it, I was scared of hugging Google.
Same.
If you feel like comfortable hacking Google, then you start finding stuff. It's like,
It is a scary target, but it's definitely doable, man. Definitely doable.
Yeah.
Let's jump to this section. I love this section you've entitled Issues in File Extension Validation Components, because you've got two pretty solid checks that I always check for as well here. And they really do help often. So talk about these two tips you have for the listeners on bypassing file extension validation checks.
So basically, whenever you have a file extension validator, you can try stuff like the null byte, etc. But in my case, I found a component that basically in the backend somewhere hidden was a crafting an URL, and you can basically you could basically do that HTML. How is that called? Like
hashtag.
The hashtag and the that PNG. Basically, the PNG was allowed and the HTML was disallowed. So basically, the URI parser ignores the rest of the hashtag. So you can basically bypass the filter that way. And
Dude, I love both this one and the question mark, right? Because it takes advantage of the differences between which characters are special characters in a file context versus in a actual HTTP context, right? You know, a hashtag is a perfectly valid character in a file name, but in the HTTP context, that is the beginning of the hash fragment, right? Yeah. Which truncates the rest of the request. So very solid. I love to see that. That's great.
Yeah, it is amazing. Like the last research made by Orange DCA with the question mark as well. Like, yeah, it is amazing.
Absolutely. You got another one here. What is this one? Uppercase?
Yeah. The next one is like simpler because it was just XML with an uppercase. That was it. Like basically some validators have a whitelist or blacklist with that only checks lowercase characters, and it doesn't check like it isn't case insensitive, basically.
Dude, I will never forget to check this because of one freaking live hacking event. And you guys have heard me talk about it on the pod before, listeners. So it's this live hacking event with freaking Matthias Carlton. He had a crit that all on a piece of scope that all of us had seen, and he bypassed like a reverse proxy because of one capital letter. We were all like, man, if we could only get access to this admin panel, and he just take one of the letters, the last letter, and he converted it to uppercase and it let him in. And I was like, I will never forget to do this ever again. So I think that's one of the beauties of the live hacking event, right, Valentino, where it's like, you know, you see all the things that other people have tried and, you know, how hard you are banging your head up against the same scope, trying, and the way you see other people solve it. And it's so like infuriating that you didn't solve that you never, ever forget in your life, you know, to do that attack vector ever again.
Yeah, sometimes I look at the show and tell, I think, oh my God, this is like something I will never think, like so creative and so like, but simple at the same time. Like,
yeah. There's both extremes. They're like, wow, yeah, I was never even close to that. But the ones that stick with me the most are the ones that are like, oh, that was right in front of me. Yes. Oh, I'm such an idiot. How did I not try that?
Yeah, that is painful. Yeah.
It's painful, man.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to jump down to this last one and then we're going to call it a wrap for the day. This was a write-up on your blog and just kind of a couple SQL injection vulnerabilities, right? This is PMB. And one of the ones that I kind of wanted to point out here is that you had an authenticated CSERF to SQLi within this write-up, right? Which I think is just a really good thing for the listeners to understand, because a lot of people would think, okay, SQLi, like, why would I need to CSERF that? Well, you know, from an unauthenticated perspective, sometimes you can't even access these endpoints. But if you are able to do a cross-site request forgery and trigger an SQL injection in the backend, your CSERF can result in something massive, like a server-side vulnerability, right? Like SQLi, or oftentimes you see RCE as well. So yeah, dude, it was great to see that right up here. And how did you learn about that technique? Was that you just kind of coming, you know, out of your head there, or did you see somebody who had implemented this before?
I basically had the SQL injection, and I thought, yeah, this is like really not great because you needed like credentials. So I thought, well, it is just a GET request, so I can see, use a cross-site request for G, and I did. Like, it was like like intuitive, like just.
Yeah, yeah, and I've actually had a good amount of success with these actually working in a bug bounty environment, because a lot of times people will be like, you know, admin C surfs, it's kind of hard to prove. But specifically within a and not in this scenario, you know, this is a different scenario, but specifically within a WordPress environment where you can create, you know, you can install the same plugin, and if there's like a C surf to RCE or C surf to SQLi in that plugin, then you know, you can prove to the triagers, hey, this works on an admin for sure, and has large impact like in SQLi and RCE. So I think that's a really good takeaway in these environments.
Yeah, it is really good. Yeah,
nice, man. I did forget about this AI hacking section down here at the bottom. Did you have any comments? I've got to wrap up here in about 10 minutes. But did you have any tips you wanted to give the listeners on the AI hacking experiences you've had with Google or outside of Google over the past year or two?
Yeah, basically, what I would say is, please always take into always think. Models are super inconsistent. So try many variations, try opening new chats, try, if you trigger the bug, don't get scared. If it doesn't work in another chat, you didn't lose the bug. They didn't fix it. Just a thing I learned is that you can just copy the entire set of instructions, paste it in another chat, and it sometimes work with a few tweaks. And yeah, that's like the most important thing I learned. And also take into consideration that some programs don't need the full chain. You can just report the data exfiltration, but I would say it is important to show you can leak sensitive data and not just regular data. Basically, another thing I will say is Markdown is just the beginning.
Yes. Agreed, man. Agreed. All right. Great tips. Let's cut it there. Leave that for the listeners to go. Thanks for coming on the pod, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for watching to the end, y'all. If you want more Critical Thinking content, or if you want to support the show, head over to ctbb.show/discord. You can hop in the community. There's lots of great high-level hacking discussion happening there, on top of masterclasses, hackalongs, exclusive content, and a full-time hunter's guild if you're a full-time hunter. It's a great time. Trust me. All right, I'll see you there.